This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
I recently bought a book that I may not need, How to Hold a Grudge. From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life, which is, well, it's a little bit of unusual advice and something that Pete Carroll knows absolutely nothing about, as he made clear, Paul, talking about welcoming Earl Thomas back. The last time we saw the Seahawks safety, he was flashing a single finger, which he later clarified was strictly for Pete Carroll. He's even talked about the reasons for it. And when Pete was talking about this yesterday, it's very clear that Pete handles life unlike most of us. He does not hold grudges.
I think it probably, you know, obviously he was upset, you know, and so, but... You know, my heart's pretty big, pretty wide open to these guys from the time we spend together and all the stuff that we do. It's way more important than something that happens, some gesture or some statement or, you know, there's a lot of chances I could have come back to stuff guys have said when they leave, you know, and I kind of have a space for them to be themselves and how they do it and how they handle it. I'm going to love them anyway.
The cynic in me has a hard time even believing that, because I feel that it's very natural for all human beings to, at some point in their lives, hold a grudge, and in particular against somebody who maybe you thought was a friend, even if you were their superior, even if you were their boss. I feel like there's always that sense of, well, why doesn't this person like me, that can stick, that can linger? And there's also a sense of, why did this person screw me over, even if it wasn't necessarily screwing someone over, in the case of Earl Thomas?
Or why did someone embarrass me in public? Why did someone feel the need, after I felt that I had tried my best to help them, why did they choose to single me out? And this is a broader question, because it's not just about Pete Carroll and his former player. It's about fans of these teams whose former players are going to come back and play them. How do you deal with sort of bumps in the road in a relationship? Because that's really kind of what it is. Earl Thomas for 9 years was a player who left everything on the field. There's nobody that I've seen that I would say plays harder. He is was uniquely focused, a maniac on the field. He was certainly on his own island within the locker room at times, but there's nothing that was, I don't know, like negative about Earl. Like Earl was just different. Like he was not someone who was. There were times where Richard Sherman you felt was undermining things or was sowing seeds of dissension. That was never Earl. But how do you deal with when the player comes back? And I think this the bigger topic of grudges, I do believe Pete. I do believe that Pete Carroll does not hold it against people when they do things. I don't think he holds grudges in that way. And I'm not sure whether or not I want to be like that or not. I'm fairly certain I can't be like that. Because I am a firm grudge holder.
Why is that? Why is that? Is there a specific reason? Was there a specific thing that led you down this path?
I'm not sure. And I don't know. Like, as we continue to work together, you're going to get to know way more about my psychology than you ever want to, because I'm pretty open with it. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's my family history, but I hold on to things. Like, I can tell you when I was 23 and I decided to leave ESPN.com and go to work at the Seattle Times, that my boss there told me, in my opinion, you're making a mistake. And I don't want to single out who it was, because Jim Jenks still works in the industry. But the fact is very clearly that I held on to that. And to the point where when he offered me a writing opportunity a couple years later, I was really, at first I was like, huh, I wonder if this is like an olive branch. And then afterwards I was like, well, you know what? You can take this olive branch and I'm just going to completely decline it. In fact, I'm going to decline it by not even returning your call.
Did you think he was being patronizing?
Yes, I did. Because he offered me a job covering a high school sports, a high school football game.
That is patronizing.
Time. Yeah. So I'm fairly certain it was patronizing. But like that's one of many different examples I've got in my personal life. I wake up on any given morning knowing pretty much where I stand with the 10 people that I have active grudges against. And I don't know I'm fairly certain it's not healthy. I'm hopeful that maybe the way I hold grudges is a healthy way to hold grudges. But that's where, when I hear Pete's talk about that, I think he's being honest. I think he's being truthful. I also completely don't understand how he's able to rise above the fact that in front of a national TV audience, his player, who he coached and worked with and helped and really tried the best for, flipped him off in front of everybody.
It's probably because he moved on. I mean, maybe they were in the process, as Earl Thomas thought, of moving on from Earl, and made that somewhat clear over the course of that last season, where they, of course, put him out there. He played well. He got hurt. He didn't get the new contract, and now he's playing against the Seahawks this coming Sunday at CenturyLink. Whatever the case, I think that for Pete, it's a little easier in this situation, where for somebody like Earl Thomas, who is saying all the right things this week, I'm not sure that's the case. He's saying these things publicly, whether it's about Russell Wilson or his time here. But I think also everyone in life has been spurned, has been maybe screwed over, messed around with. And how you handle that is difficult. And also, speak from personal experience. I mean, I feel like I've dealt with that for the first time in my life earlier this year when I was in Houston. And it's hard to move on from it. And to your point about holding grudges and about how you know you hold them, I know I hold them. I also feel like I know it's unhealthy, because I know that I allow it to manifest into all sorts of just random thoughts. And I think that the best revenge on somebody that has maybe gotten the better of you is to just completely forget about them. Or you could be a psychotic person, and you could theoretically be planning some long Count of Monte Crisco-esque revenge that you will take them down 10 to 15 to 20 years later or so.
What's your pettiest grudge? And you can think about that for a second. I'll share mine. And this comes from the 503. With Pete, it's easy. He's the dad. Your kids get emotional. The 509 also worried for me. Danny, learn to forgive. I'll be praying for you. There's a journalist in town who, when I left the Seattle Post-Intelligencer to go back to the Seattle Times, posted some things on it was a website at the PI. It was essentially an electronic work bulletin board. And he posted some things about me and how he didn't care about me and I was trying to screw his family over. So he basically said, forget Danny. Only used a different word that started with the letter F. And it was last year, somebody asked me, and because the guy, Kurt, he still works in town, Kurt Schlosser, I think his last name is, at GeekWire. Somebody's like, hey, do you want to have him on the Cairo 97.3 FM show to talk about this story? I'm like, no, the last thing I have any interest in, that's a really petty one, right? That doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't really, but I feel like I harbor those things. And maybe I do need to learn to let go. And maybe Pete's an example of that, because the healthy way to look at what happened with Earl is exactly what you just said, which is move on from it. Earl, you can understand why he was emotional. He's hurt. His feelings are hurt. And because Pete's a coach that invests in the entire person and talks about coaching all of these players, and you give them the room to say, okay, well, he's in his 20s and he'll probably mature. Hopefully he won't be like me and at your 40s, still carrying these things around from 15 years earlier, but that you move along in that sort of way. That's probably the healthier way to go about it. And I think probably, honestly, like that's the best way for a fan to look about it is to look at it instead of remembering the how it ended, to remember the high points that preceded that.
It's hard though. It's so hard, especially when at the very end, it feels personal, even if it isn't personal. I'm sure in the case of Pete Carroll and the Seahawks, it was not personal at all, but it always feels personal when you get fired. It always feels personal when you get released. It always feels personal when they don't reach out to you to give you a new contract when you are a once in a decade kind of safety, because that's what Earl Thomas is. I think we all agree on that. He had Ed Reed-esque traits. And in the last 20 years, he is in the same stratosphere as Ed Reed and Troy Polamalu as far as the best safeties in the game, the most impactful safeties in the game. And the Seahawks didn't feel that way. And I think there's ego involved. There are hurt feelings involved. There's the idea that you were living in this one place for the entirety of your professional career, and now you got to go find another place to live. And your family has to do that. And there are a lot of things that are attached to it. And I look at it from Pete Carroll's perspective, like really from Pete Carroll's perspective, okay, he probably understands deep down inside why Earl went about it that way. He might not be happy about it, but he probably understands, where Earl, I'm not sure, does. And that is a fascinating aspect of this week. As far as petty grudges go, because you did ask me about it, what are the pettiest ones that you've held? I think I've somewhat shared this with you, because this is something that I've been going through basically over the last couple of months, ever since I left my last job. At my old job, there were a lot of people that I considered myself a good friend of. I opened up with them. I was nice with them. And a lot of these people, when I was let go, did not reach out to me. But I was like, okay, whatever. It's maybe they feel awkward, something like that. And now I've seen, like, some of them have, like, just removed themselves basically from my social circle. Like, they have unfollowed me on Instagram. They have, they have unfriended me on Facebook and stuff like that. And
social
and I'm,
media?
Basically, yeah. I was actually going through it the other day. And it wasn't like on purpose, but it was
like,
one
person unfollowed me. What the hell?
I saw one person on pop up on my feed, and I was like, oh, you know what? I haven't heard from this person in a while, and for whatever reason, I clicked on the following, and I wasn't there anymore because it's like the first thing that shows up, and I was like, whoa. I mean, I was there for this person in some pretty, I thought, key moments. I was kind, all these things, and then the person just unplugs. And I thought to myself, I could just be like, ah, well, that's how life goes. But instead, I was like, no, bleep this person. You know, that's what I was thinking.
You can't quit me as a friend. I'm going to quit you as a friend.
Exactly. And this man, and I felt like a crazy person, like looking back on it a couple of hours later, because my temper spikes. And then once I like actually sit back and relax, I'm like, oh yeah, you're acting like a 5-year-old, and you need to move on from it. So I realize that these are unhealthy. I don't know how you deal with it. Because you've got like 10 that are going on right now, and
I've got one from my PE teacher when I was a freshman at Mazama High School, who wrote down my height on the last day of school as 4'11.5". 4'11.5". She couldn't give me 5 feet. That's how far back the grudges go and how petty they can be. It is Danny and Gallant. The Seahawks getting ready to host the Baltimore Ravens. We'll tell you who has the advantage when Earl and Russell kind of duel wits. But right now, it's time for What to Watch For.
What to Watch For, every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
Pete Carroll told us yesterday, there's no guarantees about DJ Fluker and Dwayne Brown getting back. In fact, I think it looks less likely after neither practice. Both held out entirely. And that probably means you're looking at another game of George Fant, as well as Jamarco Jones. And between the two of them, I thought Jamarco Jones has looked good to the point where I don't think it's a slam dunk that when DJ Fluker's back that he'll be the guy that's playing right guard. And at left tackle, George Fant, they were pretty good. I think they've got one of the better backup left tackles in the league in George Fant. So I don't find myself waiting on pins and needles. I'm assuming that neither Brown nor Fluker will play this week.
And if that's the case, it'll make things a little bit more difficult. But I am with you. Jones has been really good the last couple of weeks. And I thought Fant, who had some struggles early on, and Myles Garrett, of course, did have 3 sacks on Sunday. He's one of the best players in the NFL and also one of the biggest guys in the NFL. I don't know why anyone would decide to punch him randomly out on the streets.
Face.
Yes, which is what happened yesterday. A Browns fan said that they wanted to take a picture with him, and then they punched him in the face. Have you seen that guy? He's yoked. I saw a shirtless picture of him like this offseason. That guy is all muscle, all mass. He's like 270 pounds. That guy has a death wish. But anyway, George Fant, I thought, got a lot better as the game went on. And I don't know if that translates to the next week. I don't know if that translates to a couple of weeks, say Dwayne Brown stays out a long period of time. But with the way that Fant finished the game, I'm actually feeling pretty good about him in particular.
What to watch for.
I saw some interesting tweets yesterday, courtesy of a couple of Seattle Mariners. If you're looking for the culture to change, well, take a look at Julio Rodriguez, who tweeted, "The culture's about to change for the Mariners." And this got me thinking, Danny. In 2014, when the Astros stunk, Jose Altuve was pushing the mindset in the clubhouse that this team could be a contender soon. And this was during his first of 4 straight years where he led the American League in hits. I remember thinking in that moment right there, okay, they got something. And then the very next year, they made it into the wild card. They beat the Yankees in the one-game playoff. And they should have beaten the Kansas City Royals in 4 games, but they had an epic collapse in the 8th inning of Game 4. The Royals went on to win that series. They went on to win the World Series. It's nice to see players in this clubhouse that are already starting to take on that mentality, because someone needs to do it, because if no one does do it, then you're going to continue where you've been for the last couple of years.
Jared Kelenic said things changed to the Bleacher Report story that pointed out that the Mariners are the only team left that had not made the World Series. Julio Rodriguez said, that's about to change. Bonus points to Julio. He's the swaggier of the two statements. He also used a fist emoticon instead of the thumbs up from Kelenic. I'm getting a Julio Rodriguez jersey. I'll explain that why later.
I like it.
What to watch for.
They're going to sell beer and wine at Husky Basketball. So not only does Washington have two of the top freshmen, incoming freshmen in the country, but you're going to be able to get beer and wine, which doesn't make a difference for me at all. But yeah, I guess this. How do you
speak
feel
for yourself?
Yeah, I know. See, I feel weird making any comment about it because I'm not one, even when I was drinking and did drink, who was advocating like, man, I really wish they sold beer at college stadiums. But I also feel weird now saying it because it's kind of like if I say like, I don't know if they should really sell beer or wine, it doesn't have any impact on me.
I've always thought it's weird that schools don't have this in their arenas. And this is something that is across all of college sports. At Syracuse University in Central New York, where I went to college, that was not a problem. You could get beer, assuming you were 21 plus, at the Carrier Dome. And then I went to a Texas A&M versus Florida game, Johnny Manziel's first ever game, and I remember I was wandering around the stadium, which I had field passes for. It was the coolest experience, honestly, of my sports watching life. But before the game, I was like, yeah, I want to have a beer. Couldn't find one anywhere. Not one anywhere. And then I was explained by someone, yeah, they don't do that here. I was like, oh, so I just walked around the entire stadium looking for this for no reason? And they said yes. And I felt a little bit ashamed, and then I went back onto the field.
That is what to watch for. Now we got the professor, John Clayton, for our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
What do you know, Professor? Jalen Ramsey gets traded to the Rams, and suddenly he feels better. He's healed. His back. It's not a problem anymore. It's amazing.
Well, see, that when he walked, you know, he's kind of like walking out. You get the idea. It's like, what was the issue? It's like, back. Yeah, I don't want to go back to Jacksonville. That's what it probably came down to. That's what he was suffering about. It's like, you know, the idea of putting on a Jaguars uniform, meeting with Doug Marrone, meeting with Tom Coughlin, all those different things. He just didn't want to go back. And so, yes, I guess he's been healed now that he's been able to get out to the Rams.
ESPN's Josina Anderson said that an Eagles player told her when it comes to not trading for Jalen Ramsey, quote, we dropped the ball. I don't even want to drop that bleep. What team missed out the most by not trading for Jalen Ramsey?
Kansas City. I think that both Kansas City and Eagles are deficient at the cornerback position. You know, it's been injuries at the cornerback position for the Eagles. It's just not having any cornerbacks in Kansas City. And so they're the team that really needed to do something, particularly knowing how bad their defense is. I mean, you know, say what you want. I mean, the Rams have not done well on defense, but at least they had cornerbacks, and one of them was a former Kansas City Chief. And so now here you are, you know, can you find somebody else? Because you can see for the last two games, particularly losing at home, you know, with at least Patrick Mahomes not up to 100% because of that ankle injury, you know, you're now losing the games you should have won, even though your defense is just as bad, if not worse.
John, the Miami Dolphins, they've made no secret. Well, I guess they haven't come out and said, hey, guess what? We're tanking, but they're tanking. Everybody knows it. Are they going to be the most active team at the trade deadline? It would seem like they would dump anything of value at the NFL level.
Well, the problem is, I mean, would their mindset be? But yes. Would it be reality? Probably not, because what's left? I mean, what we're down to the stage now, we're talking about Kenny Drake, the running back, down to talking Rashawn Jones, the safety who's been kind of banged up this year. I mean, what's really left? There's nothing at the quarterback position.
Fitzmagic
is already gone. So it's like, you know, he's sitting there in Pittsburgh. So, you've been talking about Fitzgerald.
Yes, of course, the greatest quarterback of our generation.
Yeah, Fitzmagic, yeah. But, yeah, understand that it's like, you know, they put him back as a starter, and you saw it now for the last 2 years. By the second or third start, he can't play as well, and because he's just now too old. So it's a total disaster. Are you surprised, though, that Roger Goodell yesterday at the press conference said, oh, I don't think that they're tanking? It's like, oh, you don't? Well, guess what? You're wrong.
It's a challenge for commissioners, because I don't know how you tell a team not to do something that is a strategy, right? Like, you can't say, no, you can't do that with your team. At the same time, it's poison for a league to have a team that's conceding an entire season, especially in a league where they're still going to get their share of the TV revenue. I think if you see across all sports teams increasing to do this, you're going to start having a minimum win threshold where if you go below that win number, you don't get the same share of the money from the national TV contracts as other teams.
Yeah, but that's going to be tough to implement, too, because, again, it's like, I mean, these are owners, and, of course, they all make money, and so it's almost like a penalty. But yeah, somebody's going to lose. That's one thing that we know for sure, and somebody's going to have some bad fortunes with injuries and all that stuff. So I don't think you can do anything like that. I don't know what the apparatus would be to try to fix the tanking thing. They're not going to change the formula of trying to say, okay, the worst team gets the first pick, because now, you know, that gives the first team the chance to get the quarterback that might be necessary to get good. So, it's a tough situation. I guess that's why Roger Goodell just kind of talks around it.
What about relegation, John? Like, where the bottom team in a division, the worst team in football gets sent, I don't know, to the XFL or the SEC East or something like that. We'll relegate them soccer style.
Or they barnstorm.
What would assure you that the Dolphins would win if they would go in that direction?
They might not, and then we'll just never see them again. If they don't come back, that happens fine. In English soccer all the time. Like, all of a sudden, where's Jade Forrest been? I don't know. They're way down in Nottingham. They're down in Division Four. They're playing against Carpenters on the way. Yeah, that might happen to Miami, but at least we won't reward bad play.
Yeah, but look at the things going on in baseball with the tanking and how attendance has dropped off so significantly. I mean, all you have to do is look over at the baseball park if you're in Miami and see them drawing, 7,000-8,000 a game. And so, I know that the revenue is not equal to, in football, equal to the attendance because it's all TV driven. But I would have to wonder what the ratings are for Dolphin games down there, because who wants to watch that crap?
Definitely not me, but maybe if you have them like barnstorm as punishment across the world, maybe they'd be able to beat up on the teams that are like the random London team or some team that's in like Sweden or something along those lines. The NFL is pushing for a 17-game season per Roger Goodell. Do you see this happening anytime soon, John?
I could see it. It could happen in one of two ways. First, if they get the deal. Now, if it's true that they've actually increased the revenue share for the players on an offer to 49%, that's encouraging. And now one of the things they want in return is that they want money from the players, or at least a percentage from the players, to help on the new stadium in Los Angeles and maybe some of the things in the past. That's always been granted by the players because you get more revenue out of that. That's encouraging. But when you go to 17 games, you now have a chance to get about $500 million in doing so. And one of the ideas is, okay, if you go to 17 games, you might be able to supplement that by adding playoff games. But really, if you can at least get the 17 games and a 49% share, I think they're moving in the right direction there.
John, which direction do you think the Bears season ends up going? They're kind of this team they're in the middle of a pretty competitive division. Mm-hmm. They were very good last year. Do you think they end up getting back to the playoffs?
No, I don't. I mean, their defense is good enough. It's not as good now, when you take away Akeem Hicks for 8 weeks because he's on injured reserve. But I think you can see that the offense and the quarterback right now, even though he's hurt, once he comes back, is he going to be as good as he finished last year? I just think that the competitive nature of that division and also the competitive nature of the NFL and the NFC has kind of caught up to him. Because remember, I mean, part of their success last year is they didn't play many winning teams. I think they were 5-0 against winning teams and 7-4 against losing teams. Well, their schedule's tougher right now because now you have 6 games against winning teams with winning records or 500 records in their division. So everybody thought it was going to catch up to them because nobody thought that they were really a 12-win team last year, even though they were that good. So everybody thought it was going to fall back. But I think right now the teams right to win the division in the NFC North are Green Bay and Minnesota.
Myles Garrett got sucker punched yesterday. Of all players in NFL history, I'm going to give you two choices, John. Dick Butkus or Joe Green, who would it be a worse idea to sucker punch?
I'd say Dick Butkus. I mean, Joe Green would destroy you, but I mean, Dick Butkus would destroy you and then try to take your corpse and try to step on it too many times afterwards. So, no, I think Butkus would be the one that you don't want to do it against if compared to Joe Green.
What about Jack Lambert? Or maybe this is an opportunity for you to tell the feces story to Paul.
Oh, so it's like, okay, so Jack Lambert, I mean, the two stories on Jack is that, Jack would do this thing where Or Terry Bradshaw would do this thing where he would take a bottle of water, warm it up, and then go in the bathroom when a player is there, and it looked like he was trying to urinate on him. And so that usually didn't get a good response from the player. But when he did it on Lambert, Lambert chased him all through the locker room and was ready to kill him. And so, Jack was one, he'd liked a cigarette or two. And so when the coaches told him, don't go into the bar in the hotel because the coaches are there, well, Jack always would go into the bar in the hotel where the coaches were. And so he would sit there with a cigarette, and a girl comes over to him and says, Jack, what's your sign? Took a puff out of the cigarette, looked at her, and says, feces.
Oh, my God.
Professor, thank you very much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, thanks.
That is The Morning Drive with John Clayton. And the answer of which NFL player you'd least rather punch, the answer is C, Dave Wyman. Wyman described yesterday that there is pretty much nothing that would have stopped him from getting to that fan had he been punched like that and exacting physical revenge.
He chased down a purse snatcher in cowboy boots.
After knee surgery on his anniversary.
Would he chuckle after he finally caught them?
Yeah, it would be a two-chuckle Wyman. It is Danny and Gallant this morning. Oregon's defense is tough. Should I be more worried than I am? We're going to talk about that next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Halftime of Washington's game at Arizona, it looked like another debacle. A debacle in the desert. 13 points the Huskies had scored. 7 of those came courtesy of the defense, another field goal set up by a turnover. And then they reached the turning point. And what I think will be the turning point of their season, they were able to reel off a double-digit victory over the Wildcats, and they return home to face what is the biggest game of the regular season for them when they host Oregon. And I feel like Washington's offense has finally righted itself. I feel they have momentum going into this game.
You've been so cocky about this game. You really have. I don't know if it's because of your Washington versus Oregon bias right now, but I feel like to make a lot of the second half of Jacob Eason, and on top of that, to think that a game against Arizona is going to go the same way that it will against a team like Oregon, who is awesome defensively, feel like you're looking at it with
purple glasses. Are we sure they're awesome defensively?
They've allowed 25 points the last 5 games.
Who were those teams?
Those teams were, off the top of my head, Stanford,
Colorado,
Cal, and
Berkeley.
Colorado.
And then you've also got a couple of patsies mixed in there, right? You've also got a Nevada Reno team, who I believe also scored only 3 points against Hawaii. And you've got, Montana. Montana's the other team. So you're right, 25 points. And I sat there and looked at it. I'm like, am I being overconfident about that? And probably a little, but I don't think they've faced a formidable offense yet. For all that you've seen from both Stanford and Cal, and granted, Washington did not play well against those teams and lost to both of those teams in awful games. Neither one of them I would consider as having dynamic offenses. I think Washington is the best offense that Oregon will have played, certainly that they will have played since the opening game against Auburn.
They've made big plays, this Oregon defense. I think 9 different players have interceptions. This is a crazy stat. 15 different players for Oregon have at least a half sack. Isn't that a bizarre one? 15
yes.
players.
That
what
is
a lot.
What does that tell you, though?
It tells you that they're blowing teams out and that backups are getting in and that
either
backs
that
are doing the same thing.
They don't have one dominant pass rusher, right? That they don't have one dominant guy. If you've got 15 guys that have gotten sacks, that means all sorts of different people are being used to apply pressure instead of having one guy that, or two guys, or a front four that you're able to consistently rely upon.
I suppose they've forced 14 turnovers thus far this year. They are very good because they will blitz you. And I look at Jacob Eason and I feel, especially with that dumb spin move, that he will not quit.
Eventually, he's going to stop doing it. He's going to
eventually.
Stop. It's a muscle memory thing where he just keeps hitting the B button. He's going to stop doing it.
But why is it a muscle memory thing when it takes him like 2 seconds to actually get through the spin?
It's not good. I think Washington has the advantage at quarterback in this game. I really think that they have the advantage at quarterback.
Is it
this
significant?
Game. Oh, I don't know. I mean, Herbert's probably going to be a top 10 pick. Whoever picks Herbert, if he goes in the top 10, whoever picks Herbert's going to get fired. He is a top quarterback that's going to get somebody fired.
Wouldn't you feel the same way if Eason gets drafted in the first round too?
Yeah, maybe, but that's we're not talking about him. Eason's in his first year as a starter. He's got lots of. We're not even sure he's going to go out. Herbert. People thought he might be a top 10 pick if he came out last season. I don't think he has a signature win, and I really think, especially in college, you make your name with your ability to come through in big games. Deshaun Watson, the NFL overlooked. And really stupidly overlooked the fact of what he was able to do.
He was incredible
Alabama.
In big games. Yeah, and what is just Alabama either? I mean, games against Florida State, games against Louisville when Louisville had Lamar Jackson. Like, he was awesome in a lot of big-time spots.
And I'm not sure if Jacob Eason is going to be able to take that step and be big in big games, but I'm also not sure about Herbert. And I think Washington in this game, I think between the two of them, I think Eason is going to end up being the better quarterback.
I suppose I look at Eason and I just don't see it. I feel like the guy's pocket presence it leaves a lot to be desired. And yeah, he did start to figure things out as the game wore on, but I don't think that he's great at making decisions quickly. And I think that can really hurt you when you're not a guy who can move around and improvise.
You're being really generous, Paul, in pretending like I'm rational about this, because I'm not. I mean, that's of all the different things, like really when you get down to it, like there's no statistic that could have been put up where I'm going to concede that I think Washington will lose to Oregon. I felt like for 12 years I sucked it up and have taken all of the body blows that I can stand, and there's no way that I'm going to concede anything to Oregon anymore.
But, I mean, you're going into a game that's a rivalry game. Don't you want to expect the worst so
no,
that you can come
no,
out of it
no,
feeling the best?
No, that's not the dynamic of this rivalry. The dynamic of this rivalry is that Washington fans are aloof and indifferent to recent history, and we rely upon the fact that in the greater body of work that there's no comparison between these two schools. That what's happened over the past 15 years is pretty much a blip in the overall century's worth of football.
But how about the centuries going forward? I mean, they've got that Phil Knight money.
No, the overall, you take the average. You take the average of what happened over the past 100 years. It's not like all of a sudden the past 15 years tells you exactly what's going to happen going forward.
Are we going to take the average of all the money Phil Knight is putting into this program every single year compared to what Washington gets?
Well, but that's another example of how they've just got a sugar daddy who's able to.
Yes, this is where it's nice to have a sugar daddy, Danny.
Here's the other thing is I cannot take seriously the defensive prowess of a team that used to have a Disney character on its helmet. I cannot take seriously the nature of their uniforms makes it really hard for me to believe that they are going to be a dominant defense. And even though they've allowed 25 points in their last five games, I don't look at anyone on that team and I'm like, oh my gosh, that guy, they are going to come in here and they are going to clamp down on these Huskies.
I feel though that Jacob Eason does not make anything easy for this Washington offense. And I think that they're going to have a lot of issues in this one, even if it is at home. By the way, I'm going to this game.
Are you?
Yes, I am going to this game. Anything I should know as I go there? I was looking on Huskies Reddit, and I saw that apparently there are rubber duckies in the urinals or something along those
that
lines.
That tends to happen. They tend to be thrown down into the urinals. You're going to want to bring some rain gear because it sounds like it's going to pour.
Oh, it's going to pour.
It sounds like it's going to pour. The weather forecast is for it to be, well, pretty thoroughly miserable, which one of my favorite things is when Arizona teams come up here and it's really rainy to watch them just pack it in because they want no part of it. Oregon and Washington, I don't think weather gives either team an advantage if it's wet. I think they're both similar enough in their desire to pass the ball, and both teams like to watch. Oregon likes to run the ball as well. Oregon's got a really good, their best player is probably an offensive lineman. I'll be interested. It's going to be a good game, but I really do feel that Washington's offense did turn a corner at halftime and in that second half against Arizona. And that's the great thing about college football is teams do change more over the course of a season than they do in the NFL.
Can the Sean McGrew fan club, which I have officially started as of last Saturday, can we get Sean McGrew more carries? More carries for McGrew.
See it. I don't think we're going to see Newton at all this week. And McGrew's looked great, although.
And on special teams, probably McGrew, too. Like, yeah. They've had him in there returning a lot.
All the McGrew. He was he's fun. He's a little wee guy, but he hits people. He puts his shoulder into people. I like it.
Yeah. We've got Michael Bumpus coming for Blue 42. That's coming up at 8:00. But next, some of Earl Thomas's greatest hits. Emphasis on that word hit. You're going to hear him dent Rob Gronkowski next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Earl Thomas was one of my favorite players to watch. And I guess I don't have to say past tense. Earl Thomas is one of my favorite players to watch. And it was the way he played, the way he flew around. He's not a big dude, and he's someone that relies on his instincts. And man, when he pulls the trigger, Paul, he's going to go. Like that's just, he would play hunches, and he played at a speed that was, I think that's probably the thing that differentiated
Definitely.
Him most is how fast he played.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why you can compare him to Ed Reed, is because of how quickly he could move from one side of the field to the other. I think Ed Reed was a lot more fluid in the way that he did it, but for Thomas, he was just a bolt of lightning in whatever direction he so chose to go in, whether it is breaking on an interception or blitzing somebody or just trying to lay somebody out over the middle of the field.
The pick he had against the Texans in 2017, where he saw something, and you pointed this play out this morning, Paul, and looking at it, it's DeAndre Hopkins is the target on the play, and Richard Sherman's got him in coverage, and Earl Thomas pretty much comes out of nowhere here in cut number 14.
Watson out of the shotgun on third and 10. Miller stays in the backfield. Four-man rush. Watson throws down the middle. It's intercepted. It's Earl Thomas coming back near side. He's going to go midfield 40, 35. He's going to go 20, 10, 5. No flags. Touchdown, Seahawks. Earl Thomas picks it off. You can beat him once, but don't try him again. And he takes it to the house.
Watching that from the perspective of the Texans being a part of their broadcast in that game, that was such a massive play because the Texans at that point were driving. They were up 7-0 on the road in Seattle, and I think they were starting to believe. And there were a lot of distractions that week. A bunch of players had walked out on Friday of practice because Bob McNair's comments at the NFL owners' meetings about the prisons or the inmates running the prison had come out, and everyone in Houston was thinking, okay, they're not going to show up for this game. But that interception happened, and I think right away reality set back in. Earl Thomas laid down the law on the Seahawks, basically made that into quite the entertaining shootout. But that play is one of those things where he was so far back. I mean, he's 15 yards, 20 yards maybe up the line of scrimmage. He sees Hopkins going over the middle, and he knew the ball was going to Hopkins. And he somehow bolts all the way up and just ran straight up the field on that pick six too. Like just he didn't even really move. It was just a straight beeline from where he caught the ball on the hashes all the way into the end zone.
The score that he made there, and it wasn't just his ability to see where the ball was going. It was his ability to throw his body into it, too. Maybe my favorite highlight of his is he's given away, what, 50, 60 pounds to Rob Gronkowski?
Definitely.
Like in a full, I mean, he's giving away that sort of weight. Yet in a game in 2016 on Sunday night, he hit him well, it was one of the biggest impacts that I've seen on a football
field. Brady play fake, has time, throws down the seam. Nice job by Cam Chancellor. Earl was there to unload on Gronkowski, but a great defensive job by Cam on the play. And Gronk looks like he just doesn't kind of want any part of the Seahawks secondary.
Oh, he was woozy afterwards, and you could hear the hush in the cheese and wine Foxborough crowd at Gillette Stadium. That was a moment where they were like, oh, well, what's going on here? Is Gronk hurt again? That was an incredible play. And yet, you don't see a player of his size that has the ability to hit very often. Like Ed Reed, not known as a tackler, not known as a hitter, but one of the things I like a lot about Earl Thomas and why he's one of the best safeties of the last 20 years is, like Troy Polamalu, he was not afraid to stick people, but he was smaller than Troy Polamalu. You know, this is a guy that was not a very big player that could do legitimately everything as a safety.
It's hard to move on from a player like that.
And yeah.
I think that's probably part of the mixed emotions of seeing him come back with the Ravens is that I think the Seahawks made the right decision. I think even watching how their safeties play now, I think they made the right decision to turn the page. But it's really hard to watch a guy with good football left, and Earl has good football left, come back. And I don't think he would have re-signed with Seattle for the money that he took from Baltimore. I think Seattle would have had to give him a raise to keep him. But seeing him come back, it does give you – it's one of those second thoughts moments of like, man, he's still playing at a pretty high level, and sure be nice to have that guy back there because you remember all of the things he did. It's with mixed emotions that you feel him coming back.
He's still playing well, too, and I think that is the thing that's difficult to stomach, because you have a competition going on at safety right now. We'll see if Marquise Blair gets more snaps. He got 8 snaps. I think that's a season high last week. Maybe he continues to get a little bit more in there as he competes with Tedrick Thompson. 4 snaps out at safety. But when you have a guy like this and a guy that has allowed just 5 receptions for 55 yards thus far in the year with 0 touchdowns as the primary or secondary defender in coverage, I mean, that's just something that you get when you have somebody that quarterbacks know the name of. It's sort of akin to a old gunslinger in the Wild West just walking into a saloon. Who's going to mess with that guy? Very few quarterbacks are going to have the stones to do that.
Do you think you would have wanted to turn the page on Thomas?
No,
if
I wouldn't have.
If that's your decision?
In fact, I wouldn't have. Given the way that last season went, where it felt like the Seahawks were trending upwards at the end of the season, I would have decided, you know what? For the next 2 years, it makes a lot of sense to have him, no matter how nervous I am about the injury he just suffered. This isn't like ligaments or an Achilles or anything like that. It's broken bone.
You're right about that. It's going to heal. Like, that's something you can count on healing, and it's not going to be, does he have the same explosiveness?
Exactly.
It's a broken bone.
Right. So I would have kept him. Again, that's me talking about what I would do with John Schneider's money. And I also understand that the Seahawks probably thought to themselves, you know what? We have, for a long period of time, been all about our defense, but this is Russell Wilson's show now. So maybe we should just make it a locker room where everything is uniform and you don't have Earl Thomas being cat-esque, you know, to himself with his different thoughts and his different way of looking at the football that maybe he couldn't communicate, as you mentioned yesterday, with his teammates.
Yeah, that part of it, they clearly chose Bobby Wagner over him, which is always tough. I think for any player, when you watch, and for Earl, I think that's probably going to linger in the background of this game, is that they've chosen to keep other guys. They chose to extend Cam Chancellor and give him a third contract, and he just got hurt. And they chose to extend Bobby Wagner's contract this year and continue to pay him at the top of the pay grade for that position. They didn't choose to do that with him. We'll see how that pans out. I think that they made the right decision, even though it hurts here in the short term. We're going to bring in Michael Bumpus. We'll talk to him not just about the future, but how Earl will factor into this game on Sunday. That's ahead in Blue 42.